From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. At midnight, same-sex couples will be able to register to marry for the first time in Washington State. The first day marriage can occur is on Saturday. What's that going to mean for couples? What's it going to mean for how same-sex couples are viewed by the public? Joining me to talk about it, Dan Savage, sex columnist, author and advocate, creator of the It Gets Better Project, an archive of hopeful videos aimed at troubled gay youth. His books include 2005's The Commitment, Love, Sex, Marriage, and My Family, which looked at whether gay marriage was a good idea or not. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Going to be a big public ceremony at Seattle City Hall this Sunday, the first group of people. Are you going to be among them reconfirming your vows?
We will be there. Terry and I will be there, and we are debating now, just as we debated in The Commitment, whether or not we should actually get married. We're already married. We married in British Columbia in 2005 on our 10th anniversary. Our 18th anniversary is coming up. We're inclined to perhaps renew our vows because this is significant and this matters, and we want to be a part of the day.
But you said you're uncomfortable with public displays of affection and getting married about as public display of affection as you can have.
Yeah, in The Commitment, I call it the Broadway floor show of your love, but you only get one preview and one performance, and that's it. You know, marriage has a public role. Marriage is a public commitment you make, and it's kind of a commitment that the public and the culture and the society and your friends and family make to you to recognize this person who until you two met, we're strangers to each other as your next of kin, as your most immediate family member, as the most important person in your life. Mm-hmm. And so even though I'm a little uncomfortable, and sometimes people think that's ironic, I'm uncomfortable with the sort of the public performance. I'm a public speaker. I go on television aspect of the Broadway floor show of your love that is marriage. It's deeply meaningful to Terry and I, our marriage and what marriage is and what marriage means. And we're very excited about the arrival of this day. The Commitment, which I wrote in 2005, ends with looking forward to marriage arriving in Washington and the United States. For years, I've referred to Terry as the HICBAE, which stands for Husband in Canada, Boyfriend in America. And now I get to call him the HICAUBAE, which is Husband in Canada and Washington, Boyfriend in America still, because DOMA is still in force. And so we've been looking forward to this very much. We're very, very excited and very grateful.
When you got married 7 years ago, you were talking about it. And you described yourself and your partner, Terry, as ambivalent. It sounds as though you're not as ambivalent anymore.
No, we're not. You know, I'm 48 years old, and I'm sort of in between two generations of queers. The generations that came immediately before me, generation hit hardest by AIDS, which really emphasized the importance of being able to declare who your next of kin was to gay and lesbian Americans. To come out meant to really walk away from marriage and family. What you were telling your parents when you came out as gay was that you would never marry, that you would never have children. And for a lot of gays and lesbians who are a few years, 10 years, 20 years older than I am, marriage was the trap that the heterosexual and heterosexist society set for you. You would be hustled along by the closet and family's expectations and the pressures of religion into an early and ill-advised marriage in your 20s or teens and be locked into heterosexuality. And then you'd have kids, and then there was no escape. So for older gays and lesbians, many of them, not all of them, marriage was, you know, this trap that they narrowly avoided, this bear pit they almost fell into.
Sure.
And so that's where my ambivalence came from a bit when I was wrestling with it, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and I started to think about it and write about it as it became more possible, was I was inclined toward that attitude. Like, marriage as a possibility for me was I had slit that throat and buried that body by the side of the road when I was 16 years old and started coming out to my family. Mm-hmm. And then here I am all these many years later, and here comes this, you know, walking dead marriage zombie saying, I'm back.
Yeah.
This is possible for you. Mm-hmm. And younger gays and lesbians are going to grow up now in a world where hopefully soon all across the country, marriage is a choice that they can make. It's possible for them too. And a lot of us sort of reacted negatively to marriage because we had been rejected by marriage and family, so we preemptively rejected it and had to reassess our feelings about it as marriage became possible for same-sex couples.
Well, it's new here, but it's been in Canada. It's been in a lot of other states. So we've actually got some experience with same-sex couples being married. Now, it's impossible to say what any given marriage, what impact it'll have on any given relationship. Relationships are all different. Is it possible to draw any messages from what we know the impact has been on people in other places who are already married?
Well, the impact on heterosexuals who are already married in other places has been zil and non-existent.
Right.
You know, all the horror stories about gay people getting married is going to lead to the end of the family and the destruction of the human race. None of that ever seems to come true. The same people who told us 500,000 people would quit the military, 500,000 soldiers would walk out of the military if gay people were allowed to serve openly, when in actual fact only two people quit, and they were both chaplains, so not exactly needed. Not Arab translators, right, or people with the nuclear football. They're now telling us it's going to be a disaster if gay people marry, and they're always wrong.
No, I mean on the relationship themselves.
Oh, on
now
gay
the same
people.
Sex couples are married. Like, now you're married. Does
See,
that
I'm,
change?
I'm in my defensive crouch all the time. Yeah, it is going to change people. I think people, the culture at once would tell gay people that we weren't serious, our love it didn't exist because our relationships were unstable, but the culture then denied us what is provided to others to stabilize our relationships, marriage, that commitment, and how sobering that is. You know, a lot of straight people, when they date, would look at each other and think, is this someone I could be married to? Mm-hmm. I want to take that step. And they would assess the relationship using that criteria. And gay people never had to, and many didn't, and may have, you know, not dated then seriously because there was no long-term potential or expectation.
Yeah.
That's going to change for gay and lesbian people. We're going to be normalized. We asked for equal treatment and we're going to get it.
Yeah.
We're going to get it from our families, including families going, why aren't you married now to their gay and lesbian relatives and expecting them to uphold those sorts of traditions, even if they're having an untraditional genitalia arrangement in their marriage.
Now, as you alluded to, some people are still uncomfortable with the idea of same-sex marriage.
Unfortunate because now they all have to get gay married. That's the law. You know, gay people are free to get married, but homophobes are compelled to get gay married. That's how they act, as if the law is going to force them to come to our weddings and throw rice and then stand beside, you know, the bed in the honeymoon suite with a tub of lube in their hands. That is not going to happen. You don't approve. You don't have to come to the wedding, the honeymoon, or at all.
Well, it hasn't even happened here, but it's happened in other places. And is it too soon to tell how it's affected people's views of same-sex couples when they are able to get married?
It normalizes. Yeah. You know, nothing undoes someone's homophobia and fear and unwinds the demagoguery of the religious right faster than knowing someone who's gay, than knowing you know someone who's gay. Everybody knows somebody who's gay, but not everybody knows they know someone who's gay, because not everyone who's gay or lesbian, bi, or trans is out to their friends and family. And when people watch the news, even people who are opposed to gay marriage, and they see these normal, average, loving, boring couples marrying, they see that this wasn't the threat that they had been led to believe it was, that this wasn't about people storming into their church or dragging them to a wedding that they didn't want to attend. This is about individual couples making a private / public commitment to one another, and it is no threat. Love is no threat, and allowing same-sex couples to marry doesn't deprive children of mothers and fathers, which is one of the arguments against legalizing gay marriage, which is a bait and switch. You know, we should ban gay marriage because every child deserves a mother and a father. Well, Terry and I became our son's parents when gay marriage was illegal, and banning gay marriage didn't prompt me to leave Terry and marry my son's birth mother. Banning gay marriage doesn't prompt lesbians to marry their sperm donors instead of their lesbian partners. It's a non-issue and a smokescreen.
Dan Savage is my guest. He's gay married. He got gay married in Canada, and he's going to be participating in the big ceremony this Sunday as it becomes official in our state. The governor, later this afternoon, is going to sign it into law. Part of many marriage vows is the line, something like, forsake all others. You've got a different view on fidelity and marriage.
I'm faithful to Terry, and Terry is faithful to me. We are not sexually exclusive necessarily. We only hear that monogamy is a defining characteristic of marriage when gay people want to marry. And typically about gay men, this comes up. Gay male relationships are the least likely to be strictly sexually monogamous. Gay men are likelier to have an agreement about outside sexual contact. The next most likely to be monogamous is an opposite sex couple, heterosexuals. The most likely to be monogamous, lesbians. If monogamy is a defining characteristic of marriage and people who are bad at it shouldn't be allowed to marry, then men, gay or straight, should not be allowed to marry. Only lesbians should be allowed to marry if monogamy is the standard. You know, we hear that monogamy, children, religion are the defining characteristics of marriage only when same-sex couples want to get married. Mm-hmm. Straight people can marry and not be monogamous. The Clintons are still married. Straight people can marry and not have children. Pat Buchanan and his wife never had children. Straight people can have a religious ceremony or a civil ceremony. Straight people, marriage is what the two people in any particular marriage say that it is. They define their own commitment. They define forsake all others for themselves. They define fidelity and faithfulness for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so to say to gay people, oh, we're going to hold you guys and lesbians. We're going to hold you to a standard that we don't hold ourselves to as heterosexuals is so hypocritical, it's laughable.
Is monogamy unnatural for men of heterosexual or homosexual persuasion, or are we all dogs?
Men are pigs, but monogamy is unnatural. Humans aren't good at it. You know, we are monkeys in shoes, as Tim Minchin said. There are no strictly monogamous primate species. We are a pair bonding species, it seems. But there's a difference between social monogamy and sexual monogamy. 40% of, you know, some of the stats that rattle around out there, and it's hard to get accurate stats on infidelity because, you know, a researcher comes to your door and says, have you cheated on your wife? And your wife might be within earshot. But 40% of women and 60% of men in long-term relationships, and those 40 and 60% are married to each other. So in most long-term committed relationships, there has been an incident of cheating or adultery. And, yeah, we are not good at it. How many David Petraeus scandals do we need, and John Edwards and Clinton and David Vitter and everybody else, before we go, yeah, this is an ideal, and if you make a monogamous commitment, you should take that seriously and attempt to uphold it. If you can't keep a monogamous commitment, don't make one.
Yeah.
But are we as humans good at monogamy? No. We're about as good at it as we are as breathing underwater.
How do we balance sort of these two parts of ourselves, the advantages and disadvantages of monogamy versus the risks and opportunities of other sexual partners and open relationships?
Well, I think it's really important, particularly people who advocate, you know, different relationship models, to acknowledge the advantages of monogamy around paternity, obviously, if it's an opposite sex relationship, disease, emotional security. There are advantages to non-monogamy around variety, primarily, and, you know, a sense of sexual adventure and possibility, and also then an infidelity or an adultery not being a relationship terminating event.
Yeah.
That's something you can get past, perhaps. But monogamy and marriage are two separate debates. There are people in long-term relationships who are not married and have no intention to marry. My brother, Billy, who's coming to town this weekend, and his long-term partner, opposite-sex partner, a woman, are not married and not monogamous, and they're straight.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't about gay, straight, married, non-married. This is about everybody, every couple getting to decide for themselves what works for them.
My guest, Dan Savage, I recently talked to Mark Oppenheimer, who's written a short biography of you, and in it, some interesting quotes that people might not expect to hear about Dan Savage. Andrew Sullivan calling you a very conservative person. Mark Oppenheimer saying you're a cultural Catholic.
I am. And that sometimes blows people's minds. When I advocate for a little bit more realism about infidelity, adultery, monogamy, not because I'm anti-marriage, but because I think overemphasizing the importance of sexual exclusivity and monogamy destabilizes marriages. We tell people that if you're in love, monogamy comes easily. And you won't want to sleep with anybody else. It's easy to make that monogamous commitment. A monogamous commitment is hard. And so if you're with somebody for many years and they only cheat on you once or twice, they were good at being monogamous. They were bad at being monogamous. And the expectation should be the Clintons. Don't be Mark and Jenny Sanford. Like, find a way to work through this, even if it's a betrayal and it's very traumatic. The culture should celebrate, you know, Robert Patterson and Kristen Stewart from the Twilight movies. I'm sure I'm getting their names wrong. You know, there's a big public infidelity there, and they've worked it out and they've moved past it because their relationship is more important than sexual exclusivity. Why aren't we saying that? If you have kids and, you know, your partner cheats on you, the assumption should be you're going to work through this and stay together, because this happens, and there's something more important to your marriage than just sex. And people tell me I overemphasize the importance of sex. People run around saying if somebody has sex with somebody else, that marriage is over and it never meant anything and he or she, whoever cheated, never loved you. How is that not putting too much importance on sex in marriage?
Well, the advice that you might have for either a married couple or an unmarried couple in a committed relationship where someone strays, it feels like an emotional betrayal.
It is an emotional betrayal.
It's really hard to get over.
It is hard to get over.
So what's your advice to someone about getting over it?
To work through it. You know, people say to me, they write me letters, I would take a bullet for my husband.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the letter is, but I can't forgive him. It is easier to be shot than to forgive. I think you can work your way back. I really do.
On another topic entirely, you wrote a wonderful adaptation of The Miracle Worker for the Intima Theater last summer.
Didn't expect this to come up on Gay Marriage Day.
It was really terrific, and I just got a fundraising message for you for the Intima, which is still struggling to kind of get by. Are you working on another play that they might be staging?
Not for this season. They've already announced this season.
Yeah.
But I'm working on I'm talking with Andrew Russell, the artistic director of the Intima, who, so much credit to him for saving the Intimon for Seattle. He really did single-handedly save the Intimon Theater. Talking about doing a show in 2014.
How are you going to top the miracle? I mean, that was pretty.
Well, maybe you should. I don't know if I want to talk about my Diary of Anne Frank right now, but.
We await. We await it. And then just to conclude just a little bit about politics, State Senator Ed Murray, one of the architects of the gay marriage bill in, here in Washington State, announced today he's forming an exploratory committee to run for mayor. Tim Burgess is in. 4 years ago, the stranger endorsed the current mayor, Mike McGinn. What's your current thinking about politics when it comes to the mayor's race next year?
Burgess and Ed Murray would probably be mayor if they'd run in 2009. So I think you're going to see a lot of people pile into this race who have regrets that they didn't run before and have treated Mike McGinn like he's some sort of illegitimate usurper. I think Mike's been a really good mayor. I think he had some stumbles out of the gate. I think he had a lot of people rooting against him because a lot of people were angry because they thought, oh, I should have run and then I'd be mayor, not this guy. And you saw a lot of attempts, particularly by the city council, which I consider a malignant bag of toads at this moment, to undercut the mayor and make him look bad. They really were behaving like the House Republicans in the way they undercut Obama and refused to work with him. The city council, to a great extent, refused to work with the mayor and then blamed him for how little was getting accomplished. So my take right now is McGinn's dug himself out of that hole, and you know the seawall vote, I think, was really good for him, and that passed overwhelmingly. And we'll see what happens. I'm excited about Ed running. I've been a friend and fan of Ed Murray's for a long time. Ed was absolutely, you know, what Ed did in delivering, working with Jamie Peterson, marriage equality to Washington yeah. State incrementally was the right thing. And he got a lot of grief for that. So Ed can take the long view and do the right thing, even if he's putting up with a lot of pushback. So it's going to be an exciting race. We'll see.
If he asks you, Dan Savage, for your personal endorsement or the endorsement of the stranger, what are you going to tell him?
Ed Murray?
Yeah.
If
he hasn't, I'm sure he's going to.
To come and get in line to, you know, come to the stranger. And, you know, the stranger, when we're for someone, we're really for him.
I've noticed that.
So Mike McGinn was on the cover. We wrote a series of stories called The Case for Mike McGinn week after week when he was running against whoever that guy was. No one even remembers his name. Seattle's Mitt Romney.
Malahan,
right. But we're, you know, we have an open door and we've shifted endorsements before. But right now, McGinn isn't as unpopular in our offices as I think some people hope that he is.
Dan Savage, thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate it. And have a good time on Sunday.
Thank you so much.
They're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Ross Reynolds.